The Takeaway is supported by TechServe, offering Mac computer repairs for screen fixes, liquid damage, backup services, hard drive issues, and other problems. More information at techserve.com.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Thanks so much for listening on this Friday. Back in 2007, before Elizabeth Warren was a senator with presidential candidate potential, she was an economist, giving PowerPoint presentations and making predictions in stuffy academic speeches.
I fear we're moving from a three-class society to a two-class society.
Professor Warren predicted that the middle class was vanishing in America, a prediction that was all about numbers, but also about a feeling.
Help me, I'm poor.
You know that, right? You saw that movie. Part of why Kristen Wiig's little aside in Bridesmaids getting kicked out of a first-class airline seat is so funny is because it feels like the malaise in the middle class right now.
She can have my seat, okay? Everyone should experience first class at least once in their lives, and Annie shouldn't miss out just because she can't afford it.
No, ma'am, I'm afraid that's not allowed.
Help me, I'm poor.
No.
Help me, I'm poor, a pop culture joke that reflects a feeling that a miserable class is growing in America. But solid economic data says that the technical middle class is shrinking, and America's increasingly consisting of a small but growing class of massively rich and very well off, and then...
The rest is just one long trail of underclass that stays on a constant debt treadmill. Sometimes it's a little more, sometimes it's a little less, but never out of debt. Never any real economic security. I could change my metaphors. People who are just constantly living on the edge of a cliff.
Where legitimate or not, people are quietly shouting into the void as their credit cards are declined, they get turned down for loans, they fall into foreclosure or lose a job, lose their health, lose their future, and plead,
help me, I'm poor.
It's not funny anymore when you look at it that way.
Hi, I'm Laura Miller from Alameda, California. I once felt I was middle class. I took it for granted. I owned a condo, was a registered nurse, and my daughter was going to a decent college. Then I had to walk away from the condo after I retired, and now I am renting, and I really have to watch my pennies. I'm sure I would now be labeled, at best, lower middle class.
Hi, this is Claire. I'm a single mother of five, living in Brielle, New Jersey. Before divorce, I lived an upper middle class life. How eye-opening it is to now exist below the poverty line. All the red tape involved to determine eligibility for social services, choosing not to go to the emergency room, since that is the only option when you're uninsured. The quote-unquote haves mostly are clueless as to what it's like to be a have-not. I know this because I've been in both worlds.
From St. Paul, Minnesota, like many Americans, I still struggle to make ends meet and maintain the lifestyle I'm accustomed to. However, I'm a master's degreed social worker with a single income of over $65,000 a year. The latest data from the Pew Research Center confirmed that the middle class is now less than a majority in the U.S. for the first time. While the number of people in poverty is growing, and the better-off households defined by Pew as earning more than $125,000 a year, or twice the median income, now make up more than 20% of the U.S. population. The Financial Times sees this as a huge moment for America's sense of self, and they explored these numbers in stories of people and places around the country in a new series. Sean Donnan covers international economics for the Financial Times and is one of the lead reporters on the paper's new series, America's Middle Class Meltdown.
We're seeing a real divergence in American society. And what's interesting about these numbers that have come out from the Pew Research Center and that we've built our series around is that really this is the broadest measure in terms of income of the American middle class out there. This goes from two-thirds of median income in America today for a household of three people to 200%, twice median income. And that's a huge range in terms of income, $41,000 or so a year to $125,000 plus a year. So you're capturing a huge segment of the American labor force, and yet that's less than a majority now in the American economy.
The middle class used to be, I'm not rich, but I'm doing just fine. And that was the sort of role in American society that the middle class played. Now we're looking at a large group that certainly doesn't feel rich and absolutely doesn't feel like they're doing okay and really lives in a feeling of economic menace. Is that a fair sort of characterization of the psychological shift here before we get into the numbers?
So that's definitely one side of the story. So there's the side of the story that is actually, there's a lot of Americans who are a lot more comfortable than they used to be. And that's been a slow process over 40 plus years. The numbers go back to 1971. There are now 50 million American adults living in households earning more than $125,000 a year. That's a pretty comfortable place to be. The other side of the story is exactly what you've described, which is that sort of tenuous hold on that comfortable middle-class existence. And there are people slipping out down the bottom. And that gets into a lot of what we're seeing in politics around America today.
So in the lowest income, what do your data show there?
So basically, you need to think of half of America, or just under half of America, sitting in the middle. And then really, you've got one-fifth of America living on less than $31,000 a year, half of them below the poverty line. And then you have the fifth at the top. And that lower end has continued to grow since 1971. In 1971, it was 16% of the population. In 2015, it's 20% of the population. And it has gone up since the crisis in 2008, which clearly has played a big role in this and making everyone feel a lot more fragile.
You divide middle income into lower middle and middle. What do those numbers mean, and why do you make the difference at about 42,000?
So that's a distinction that the Pew Research Center makes. And then basically, there is the middle, which is using that measure of median income going from two-thirds to twice middle income. And that's sort of designed to kind of capture that kind of comfortable middle. But then there is that what they call the lower middle, which is those people who are between $31,000 and $41,000 a year. Again, that's for a household of three. In a lot of America, that's not a very comfortable place to be. So I think it's they're not poor, but these are clearly the people who are at risk in an economic crisis. What was really interesting about the reporting for the series was getting out there and really asking that question, what does it feel like to be middle class in America today? And what you discover is that often how positive you're feeling about the economy doesn't necessarily correlate with just how much money you're making. It depends a lot on what you're seeing around you. So I had a really interesting experience in Seymour, Indiana. Met a young woman called Amber Barnard. She's 37 years old. She's a mother of three. She works on a factory floor for Cummins. She's a slight woman, but she makes great big diesel engines. She's had that job for 11 years, and she's this kind of counterintuitive story of American manufacturing. She's managed to hang on. She was the most effusive person I met, and I met dozens in traveling around America, in kind of her current economic state. She says, hey, look, it used to be really tough here in Seymour, Indiana during the crisis. People were losing jobs, houses were being foreclosed, but now things are looking really good. And yet, actually, you can talk to people who are further up the income scale. And I was talking to scientists in Atlanta and architects, and I was in Eden, North Carolina. You really find people feeling a lot more vulnerable. I think that's a lot of that has to do with the nature of the labor market today. You know, none of us is convinced that we're going to be in the job that we're in. We're going to have the same security that our parents did. If you're in my generation, or if you're further up, or if you're older, that you may have had 20 or 30 years ago, you're not going to work for one company for your entire life. And any measure of job security just makes you feel a little bit better.
These numbers show a huge sociological shift. At the time that the middle class, as we know it in America, was created, elderly people were among the worst off in the United States. That situation has completely reversed. The elderly are now among the best off, and there's a sense in the middle, or as I like to say, miserable class, who feel they'll never get to the state that the 65s are in. That says a lot about your ability to plan for the future, your sense of charitable giving. That has all kinds of repercussions in the economy. How do you see it?
Yeah, so I think there's something counterintuitive here. So you got to remember, what we're measuring and what these numbers measure is income. You've got to be working and you've got to be deriving an income. If you're retired, you in some ways don't show up in these figures. So the fact that older people are hanging on in the workforce longer could be a result of lifestyle choices. It could be a result of economic realities. I mean, one of the people we met in our reporting was a woman called Evie Osterman in Florida, who's an office manager, and she's 75 years old and she's still working. And she says she's happy. She's a happy member of the middle class. But the truth is, she actually needs to be working to maintain the lifestyle that she has become used to. And at 75, I don't think many of us expect to be working anymore, but that might be the future that we have.
Have these data reinforced a sense of racial disparity in the United States, as well as the income inequality that's a campaign issue in 2016?
Yeah. So on the race side, look, you know, between 1971 and 2015, the American middle class has become less white than it used to be. It was 80% white in 1971. The next biggest ethnic group was Hispanics on 11%. You found 7% of the middle class was black. Those numbers have improved, but they probably haven't improved as much as many of us would have thought. Today, the American middle class is 67% white, 15% Hispanic, 11% black. The big winners have in terms of really surging in the middle class, have been Asian Americans, who now make up 6% of the American middle class. It doesn't take you long when you get out there on the road to interrogate these numbers and look at the reality on the ground and to realize that to be black in America today is not as easy as being white in America today, and that the opportunities to enter the middle class, if I grow up in a predominantly African American neighborhood, just aren't the same as they are if I grow up in an affluent white suburb.
Finally, Elizabeth Warren predicted that the decline of the comfort of the middle class would mean that the middle class would have less of an appetite to give to the poor, that there would be less of an income transfer coming from the middle class to the poor, and that would bear directly on the sense of alarm and the growth of poverty in America. Do you see that?
That's a really, really interesting question. I mean, I do wonder sometimes when we look at the debate now about the state of the middle class, whether what we're missing is that actually the really vulnerable in America are having a much tougher time than they used to. The support mechanisms just aren't there in the same way that they were before welfare reforms in the 1990s. America is a tougher place to be poor today than it was 20 years ago.
Economic data, political rhetoric, a moment of real pause in these numbers. Sean Donnan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Sean Donnan covers international economics for the Financial Times. He's one of the lead reporters on the paper's new series, America's Middle Class Meltdown.
Hi, I'm Aaron Boise. I'm calling from Portland, Oregon. I think middle income is disappearing, and the only way we're going to get it back is government has to stop overspending overseas. And the fat cats in Washington, D.C. need to cut their salaries back, too.
Hi, this is Jeff from San Jose, California. Yeah, definitely in the middle class now. 4 years ago, left a cozy digital media gig with a great Silicon Valley life, including a BMW rocket ship. Now I drive an older Toyota Tacoma, have about $50,000 in student loan debt and $30,000 in credit card debt. Very, very happy here with our three daughters, and you know, it's just different stuff.
We always want to hear from you. Give us a call at 8778-MY-TAKE, and you can read more about those middle-class numbers from the Pew Research Center at thetakeaway.org.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, brain training designed by neuroscientists that has been used by 60 million people worldwide. With personalized training programs to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving, learn more at Lumosity.com.
While the rest of the world eagerly awaits the final outcome of the COP21 climate change conference, the U.S. Congress has about as much enthusiasm for the agreement as it has for the metric system used by the rest of the world, shunned curiously in the U.S. Senator Ted Cruz celebrated this contrary view of climate change. In a Senate hearing this week, he called to claim that climate science was the product of a cabal of power-hungry politicians and scientists eager for federal grant money. Global warming, he says, is just wrong.
According to the satellite data, there has been no significant global warming for the past 18 years. Those are the data. The global warming alarmists don't like these data. They are inconvenient to their narrative, but facts and evidence matters. And I would note that many in the media, reflexively take the side of the global warming alarmists.
That's Senator Cruz, presidential candidate, of course, speaking at his hearing. But Dr. David W. Titley, professor of practice in meteorology at Penn State and director of the Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk, was also called to testify by Democrats. Admiral Titley went after Cruz's view of climate data, calling his performance masterful rhetorical trickery and dreadful science.
Science is based on the weight, the cumulative weight of evidence. And you get a lot of different things coming in. But what we have seen really over the past 50 and 60 years in climate science is actually a remarkable convergence to a position that does show that the Earth is warming. We know that's happening, and we know why. We know it's because mankind is putting greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. Now, we derive tremendous benefits from fossil fuels. I'm not trying to demonize anyone or anything, but now that we understand that, we should realize that there are very significant consequences. So what's the saying? When you're in a hole, stop digging. We need to move on.
People might doubt, and you certainly take issue with Senator Cruz's expertise scientifically and the way he uses data, but few people would take issue with his expertise in a rhetorical sense. What I would like to do is play for you an exchange that took place on public radio this week between Senator Cruz and a radio host. And it seems as though Cruz gets one past this individual. And I'm wondering if you were there going at it with Senator Cruz, what you might say.
The scientific evidence doesn't support global warming. For the last 18 years, the satellite data, we have satellites that monitor the atmosphere. The satellites that actually measure the temperature showed no significant warming whatsoever.
I'll just note that NASA analyzes that same data differently.
No, they don't. You can go and look at the data. But here's the key point. Climate change is the perfect pseudoscientific theory for a big government politician who wants more power. Why? Because it is a theory that can never be disproven.
I'm not sure anything that any scientist or any other person says is going to change his tactical position. And, you know, maybe it's another discussion as to why Senator Cruz believes, you know, he is, as you said, he is a very smart individual. I mean, so he's not dumb. He understands the science, but he has locked on to this because he believes this will, I think, further his political fortunes. The science, the factual components of this are several. One, the satellite is in fact not measuring temperature. It measures basically microwave returns. It turns out, as I mentioned in the testimony, it's actually not rocket science, but it's a lot harder to convert those into temperatures. The people who have done that before have in fact had numerous errors, which have had to be corrected by independent analysis. And as those errors have been corrected, that satellite data in fact shows more and more warming. But even if you, say, accepted the data that Senator Cruz presents at face value, he's actually averaging parts of the atmosphere that we know are cooling. The top of the atmosphere, the stratosphere, is cooling while the bottom is warming. So if you average, you know, just anybody, if you take plus one and you take minus one, add them up together, what do you get? You get zero. So, and then he takes this very, very specific 18 years. He is very much on message with his 18 years. Why? Because he's starting from a point that we had a huge El Nino in 1998, and he's connecting it to today. So a question that you could ask Senator Cruz is if there are these natural variations and you've started from a very high El Nino, it's amazing, sir, that your data, in fact, does not show a decrease. If we were just having natural ups and downs, this is where the down would be. So why didn't we get a down? Why have we had so many years, 10 of the last 12 years have been some of the warmest on record? That doesn't sound like no global warming. It sounds like we had a very high plateau, and now 2014 and 2015, we're going back up the staircase again. This is how climate changes. It doesn't change in a nice straight line. You have ups and downs, but the downs are now flat and the ups are really up.
Do you think there's a conspiracy of big government politicians that want more power and are using global warming to get it?
I've worked in the government for nearly 35 years, mostly in the military and a little bit with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. So one of the things I learned is even if the government wanted to do that, we're not good enough. I mean, we're just not good enough. You look at all the foils and silliness that we see in the federal government, we can't do that. Look at the things we do want to keep as secrets. And then look at what's exposed. Look at the damage, in my opinion, that Snowden has done to the National Security Agency. I mean, I sometimes tell people, you know, this is the government that had a hard time building a website for the president's highest domestic priority. Do you really think they're good enough to do a conspiracy? But as I said, at a more basic level, the conspiracy is frankly, it's laughable.
David Titley, thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Dr. David W. Titley is professor of practice in meteorology at Penn State and director at the Center for Solutions to Weather and Climate Risk. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Huckenberry. The scrimmages are over for House Speaker Paul Ryan. It's his first big test, a budget vote and a deadline tonight with government operations hanging in the balance. Is that a fair way of characterizing what's going on this weekend, Todd Zwillich?
Yeah, I think it's a pretty fair way, although Congress, John, has already given itself a check on that board. They've given themselves a 5-day grace period because it became obvious a week or 10 days ago they were not going to hit this deadline. There are way too many controversial riders being negotiated to get this thing passed by the deadline. Not going to happen. We're going at least to Wednesday to find out if they're going to avoid a shutdown. And they probably will. Nobody wants one. But there's a lot of important stuff embedded in these negotiations that are really tying lawmakers in knots. The top budget lines, the big spending, those problems are solved. Remember the big budget deal that they struck, that John Boehner struck on his way out the door? The top spending numbers are set. They're not fighting about that. What they're fighting about is a whole list of other things. How about EPA rules on clean water and clean air and coal? Republicans want to repeal a lot of Obama administration regulations on that stuff. That's in the mix. Of course, Planned Parenthood funding, defunding Planned Parenthood. That's part of the discussion. That's been diffused a bit because Planned Parenthood was defunded in a budget vote they took a couple of weeks ago that's probably not going to pass the president's desk anyway. Now, John, here's something important. Republicans want to also expand the definition of religious exemptions to Obamacare family planning mandates. This is all about Hobby Lobby. Remember that Hobby Lobby decision where they wanted religious exceptions to the family planning? Republicans say they want to expand that definition. Democrat Dick Durbin said if they try that, he said all hell will break loose. And John, here's one more that I know you're going to like. Harry Reid himself is annoying Democrats on his own side because he wants a rider that would let Caesars, the casino company, refinance a bankruptcy out of court and save a whole lot of money. They can't do that right now. Bondholders don't like it. And Elizabeth Warren doesn't like it because she says that's going to help for-profit colleges that bilk students. So there's a lot going on there.
So let's assess the tone of Speaker Ryan on the House side. Is he ushering this through in an orderly process, or is he a bit of a slave to the zealots who have all these various riders?
He's trying to be extremely orderly. That's why they've had this delay. He says, I want to get this right. I'm not going to negotiate it in public. We're not going to have any showdowns. We're going to let everyone have their say. We're going to let people like Matt Salmon of Arizona have their say. He's a pretty hardcore conservative, and he wants that language from the Syrian refugee ban included here. Listen to Salmon.
Really, the one drop-dead issue for most of us is that we want to make sure, especially given the fact that this is an issue that I believe all of America is with us on, that we need to err on the side of caution when it comes to not just the refugee vetting process, but we've learned now that the K-1 process has got holes you can drive a Mack truck through.
The K-1 process, of course, is the spouse visa, right, that relates to the San Bernardino, the woman in the San Bernardino shooting.
Yeah, that's right. So Paul Ryan is really going for order and sort of steady progress towards a deal here. John, there's another issue. Listen to Nancy Pelosi. She sprung something yesterday that'll be of interest. We've been covering the issue of the CDC ban on gun research. Here was Nancy Pelosi yesterday, a surprise.
Our priority is to remove the ban on research on gun violence. Let's do it today.
Does she have a chance at doing that?
yet she really seems like she doesn't. It was a surprise to a lot of people. We've covered this issue, John, and I asked Nancy Pelosi directly after that, does this mean no Democratic votes on the spending deal if the CDC ban doesn't come out? She didn't say that, John. She just said, no, it doesn't mean that. It just means this is our priority. And that tells you a lot about whether or not Nancy Pelosi and the Democrats are going to go to the mat over this.
Well, we've got till Wednesday on the budget. We'll talk to you then. Todd Zwillick, Takeaway Washington correspondent, thanks so much.
You got it, John.
The story now of a politician taking action in response to the San Bernardino terrorist attacks. No Trump-like flourish of xenophobia here. Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy, in the state where the U.S. gun manufacturing industry began, announced a ban on the sale of guns to those on the federal terrorism watch list. Reasonable step? Misguided feel-good gesture that intent on evil criminals could easily find a way around? Colin McEnroe is host of the popular Colin McEnroe program on Connecticut Public Radio. Which is it, Colin, and what do Connecticut voters think?
I don't think we know what Connecticut voters think yet. This has obviously caught people a little bit by surprise yesterday. A couple of little details that have emerged recently that are worth noting. First of all, he may not be the first. It does appear as though shortly after Sandy Hook, shortly after Newtown, which obviously is one of the things that radicalized Dan Malloy, New Jersey did something very similar. There may be a New Jersey law just like this on the books. Now, whether or not New Jersey ever promulgated the legislations and action, the regulations and actions that would be necessary to make this a reality, I don't know. It's too early to tell. But we might not even be the first. Now, there's a welter of other questions about whether or not this is constitutional or whether or not it's even doable. And we can get into that.
The federal terrorism watch list, is that a designation that allows the states to take actions that would, in theory, violate the Second Amendment?
I'm sure that Governor Malloy didn't do what he did without at least reaching a little bit back through federal and White House back channels. Is this going to be okay? Are you going to slap me down about this? Can we actually do it? So I'm sure he asked some questions about that. It just stands to reason. And the problem here is this is an interesting place where a couple of ideologies can kind of collide. You can be in favor of gun control, but still have questions about whether certain people should be able to get on planes and whether people who can't get on planes should be able to buy guns. On the other hand, there's some real due process questions here. The ACLU has real problems with this so-called terrorist watch list. The no-fly list is kind of a subset of a larger FBI database, and it includes people who may have actually engaged in terrorist activities, but also people who might be suspected of having engaged in terrorist activities. That gets pretty murky, and when you start talking about depriving people of their rights based on not very much, certainly nothing that resembles due process, you're going to have some problems from the ACLU sector, which, as I say, is a very different ideology.
So this is less a gun control debate and more an innocent until proven guilty kind of debate, which is what the due process issue is here. Is there precedent for federal designations leading to specific bans on any sort of behavior outside of even the gun control argument?
I would hesitate to say that there is no precedent, because then it'll turn out that it's just one that I don't know about. But it's a pretty unusual thing. And, of course, the hallmark example that people keep bringing up, that somehow or other Senator Ted Kennedy wound up on this list very briefly. So, and there certainly are thousands of examples of people who've wound up on this list, not seem to have any basis for being on the list, and have just kind of appeal their way off of it. So you have to ask yourself a question about whether or not somebody in that position should be deprived, while they're not on planes, of their ability to own a firearm.
Is this controversial in the state where the gun manufacturing industry in America began?
I think it's controversial to the extent that people who already don't like some of the other things that Governor Malloy has done, and once again, in the wake of Sandy Hook, Governor Malloy did push through some legislation that did affect the ownership of particularly kind of high-capacity so-called assault rifle-type weapons. The people who were already bothered by that are going to be bothered by this. On the other hand, I mean, I think in general, all of us were radicalized, or most of us were radicalized by what happened in Newtown. So, I mean, he probably has a little bit more wind in his sails than a lot of governors would. I should also say that he has two roles here. He is the governor of Connecticut. He's the recently elected president of the Democratic Governors Association, which means that in this campaign season, this national campaign season, he'll be pushing and staking out certain kinds of Democratic positions. And sometimes he'll probably do things to make other Republican governors look bad or weak or inconclusive about an important issue. So this may be as much symbolic as it is anything else.
Good point. Colin McEnroe, host of the Colin McEnroe Show on WNPR Connecticut Public Radio. Colin, thanks so much as always.
Have a good day.
When I was 17, it was a very good year.
1915 was a very good year because that's when the chairman of the board came into this world, Frank Sinatra, born a century ago tomorrow, into a timeless story of celebrity, brutality, and excess. Every flaw, though, instantly forgiven because Frank, you see, could sing.
Recalls a love that used to be the dreams I dream. Only the lonely dream.
Sinatra sang such lyrics in a way that was beyond the music he never learned to read. Sinatra's talent was something even he had difficulty understanding. Moody, insecure, he reportedly tried to commit suicide twice during his career, which began in the 1940s and ended the night of his last heart attack in 1998, on the same night as Seinfeld's last episode.
What a world, what a life, I'm in love. I got a song that I sing, I can make the rain go. Anytime I move my finger.
Frank was a musical genius, and a genius he was.
That's Jonathan Schwartz, who knew Sinatra well. Schwartz's father, Arthur, wrote songs for Sinatra. Jonathan was dubbed by Old Blue Eyes his best informed fan. Schwartz is a longtime radio legend and host of New York Public Radio's Jonathan Channel. Schwartz long ago coined the phrase the American songbook. He says Sinatra lived in that songbook and gave it life as well.
He changed everything. He is the greatest interpretive singer that we've ever had.
What does that mean, interpretive singer?
That means that he takes material written by other people and interprets that material, that's those songs. Harold Arlen's Stormy Weather.
Don't know why there's no sun up in the sky, stormy weather.
He made three records of, actually four, of Stormy Weather through the years.
I don't mean to be too pointy-headed about it, but I mean, he found in this interpretive zone so much, such a rich... It was like there were three or four layers of song there that the composer never even knew about.
That's genius.
Yeah.
And, I don't throw around the word.
No.
Let's listen to The Wee Small Hours.
In the wee small hours of the morning, while the whole wide world is fast asleep.
A man named Jack Mann, he was a pianist, and his lyricist, Bob Hilliard, they were together one night playing cards till about 2 o'clock. And Bob Mann said, I think I'm going home. He lived in Manhattan. Hilliard said, let's write a song. And Mann said, it's too late. And, okay, he sat down at the piano. And he played out the melody of In the Wee Small Hours of the Morning as if it had been there before.
In the wee small hours of the morning, that's the time you miss most of all.
And Bob Hilliard, respecting this, wrote his lyric. Bob Mann left, put the sheet music in his overcoat, it was February. The next morning, Mann grabbed a cab and went downtown for some business. And just on the south side of Columbus Circle, cab was stopped for a light in front of another cab. And out of that other cab came Nelson Riddle and Sinatra. And Bob Mann knew them very well all his life. And he pulled down the window and said, "Frank, Nelson." And Frank gestured to him, come here, follow us." And Bob Mann followed them into Capitol Records. It had a small office there at that place. And they went into a room. They were sorting through songs that would go on a 16-song album when they made it. And as they did, a man was just watching them, Bob Mann. He thought, wait a minute. And he went to his overcoat and he pulled out the song that he and Hilliard had written the night before and handed it to Sinatra. Sinatra looked at it and said, "That's my kind of song." Now you understand, if one of those cabs had been 2 seconds earlier or later, no Wee Small Hours.
Did Sinatra have an idea of the kind of singer he wanted to be? Did he want to be a pop singer? Did he want to be a phenomenon that he became? Did he want to sell a number of records? Did he have any sense of the record industry like we understand it today?
None of those things. He worshipped Crosby as he grew up, loved the songs he heard on the radio. Later on, many years later, in the early 70s, he gave an interview to a friend, a woman he trusted, Arlene Francis, who did a program on WOR.
Sure, I remember it well.
45 minutes. And the subject came up, similar to yours, and he said, "I loved Bing's, those records. I listened to them all the time. I knew I wanted to sing. I didn't want to sing like that," he said. "I had some other ideas." Now, the other ideas turned out to be, certainly one of them, to make song speech, those long lines of music that he holds, very much could be received as a conversation like we're having.
Mm-hmm.
"This is a lovely day, and we're here talking on the takeaway, and I can't no breath, I made a breath." In other words, He wanted to make the song as close to the speech as possible, and he began to swim underwater. His buddies in Hoboken said, "What you doing, Sinatra? Come up out the water, join us. What's the matter with you?" But he knew what he was doing at a young age.
Jonathan Schwartz, thank you so much.
You're entirely welcome, Mr. Takeaway.
Jonathan Schwartz is the host of New York Public Radio's Jonathan Channel, where he guides listeners through decades of tunes drawing from his encyclopedic knowledge of music and friendships with the likes of Frank Sinatra, Stephen Sondheim, and Mr. Takeaway. Here's something to take with you today. Saudi Arabia is dipping a toe into the 20th century this weekend. Women candidates are running in their first election, and Saudi women are headed to the polls for the first time in municipal council elections across the country. But no shenanigans allowed. Women must speak from behind a partition, with male relatives standing in to do any glad-handing or, God forbid, baby kissing. Go ahead and push the envelope on social change. That's the message from the royal family. But support a Saudi woman's right to drive, and you'll be disqualified and kicked off the ballot. Still, nearly 1,000 women are running, and more than 130,000 have registered to vote for women candidates who are assured of having virtually no power. But what would be the point of that? We began today with the middle class and leave you in the Middle Ages. Have a nice weekend. Don't flog anyone now. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo. Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.